an adult man told me about something that happened to him as a child that was one of the most traumatic experiences of his entire life, and he gave me permission to share it publicly as long as I kept it anonymously. He was about 8 years old at the time. Though he had older brothers and sisters, for some reason they were not around at that particular night that this happened. He really didn't remember why or how it happened, but he remembered hearing from another part of the house where he was living his mother screaming. Then he heard his dad's voice, and it too was very loud and very distressed. As the little boy went from one part of the house to closer to where his parents were, he could hear more clearly, and the sounds were more frightening than ever. When he opened the door and came into the living room, the sight frightened him more than almost any sight, he said, he had ever seen or heard before that or since that for probably more than 40 years. His dad and mom were physically fighting. Dad had mom down on the floor, and mom was kicking and screaming and crying. They were grabbing and pulling at each other's clothes and arms and face. Dad was trying to reason with mom, but the situation had reached the point where reasoning was totally out of the question. Would you look with me at Romans chapter 12? My key verse will be verse 18. We'll begin reading with verse 14. In fact, read these verses from verse 14 through verse 18 out loud with me, if you would please, all together. Bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not. Rejoice with them that do rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Now notice again verse 18. I want to read it again. Think about it very carefully. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Would you think right now? Would you think of that person that it is difficult for you to get along with? Would you think right now of that person or persons that you would like to have a close relationship with them, but it is very difficult for you to have a close relationship with them? You tend to have conflicts with them. You tend to have run-ins with them. I want to speak to you on the subject this morning, how to get along with difficult people. Notice again the verse. Read it again out loud with me, would you please? If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Actually, as I thought about this, I couldn't settle on a title, so I gave this three different titles, all right? How to get along with difficult people, or how to deal with difficulties in relationships, or how to get along with anybody, or how to get along with anybody most of the time. Now, let me point out a couple of key thoughts just as a part of my introduction before I get into the meat of the message. First of all, don't ever forget that the joy of life is in relationships. I have seen people who were wealthy and did not know they were wealthy. What do I mean by that? I mean that I've seen people who were either a father or a mother or a son or a daughter in a good family and did not realize that they had something far more valuable than having lots of money in the bank. Luke 12:15 says it plainly, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth." I'm looking at some wealthy people this morning because I'm looking at some people who have some wonderful relationships in life. That is the stuff of life. The stuff of life is not the stuff of life. The stuff of life is the relationships of life. I heard a story about a very financially wealthy man. And, I mean, he was extraordinarily wealthy and lived in a huge, fine home with all of the fine things that went with it, cars and everything. And he said to a preacher one day, he said, "I'd give it all if my grown daughter just loved me." Proverbs 13:7 says, "There is that maketh himself rich, yet he hath nothing. There is that maketh himself poor, yet hath great riches." Just because somebody looks rich doesn't mean they are. If you have wonderful relationships, you are wealthy. Do not take relationships for granted. Don't take for granted your relationship with your parents, with your grandparents, with your brothers, with your sisters, with your, and so on. I've talked to a lot of guys who were selfish and self-centered and didn't realize what their wife was worth till she left him. Then he realized he had been wealthy and let his wealth get away because he didn't treasure it. A lot of relationship problems could be solved if people would just realize what they have in those relationships and treat them as something valuable instead of as something cheap. That relationship could be a relationship of pure gold, but some people throw it away not realizing its value. They'll just say, "I don't care." So, the joy, that's still my introduction, the joy of life is relationships. And then secondly, any relationship can be difficult or strained. The husband-wife relationship can be sweet or it can be strained. The parent-child relationship can be delightful or it can be difficult. The same is true with the pastor-people or people-pastor relationship. The same is true with brother-sister relationships or brother-brother relationships or sister-sister relationships. They can be delightful or they can be difficult. The in-law relationship can be sweet or it can be strained. Now again, I'm speaking on how to get along with difficult people. And with this verse as our foundation, if it be possible, as much as it is life in you, live peaceably with all men. Think with me several thoughts. Number one is this. Want to get along because the Lord wants you to get along. You ought to want to get along not just for yourself, but because if you love God, your testimony as a Christian is at stake in not what the things you possess. That your testimony as a Christian is at stake in the relationships that you have. I ask you, do you want to please the Lord? Then notice His command that I've just read several times already. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. That's a command from the Lord. Do you want God's blessings on your life? 2 Corinthians 13:11 says, "Be of one mind, live in peace, and the God of love and peace shall be with you." So, God's presence on your life, God's blessings upon your life, to a certain extent are dependent upon what you do about the relationships of life. Hear me? Bad relationships don't always have to stay that way. Now, I know that there are some cases where nothing you can do will change that other person. I know that. I've dealt with that. I've lived with that sometime. And all you can do is make sure your heart is right with them because they are not going to get right with you. I mean, you can do everything you can. Some people are not going to get right with you. But that is not always the case. I know there are cases where you have to separate from somebody because of the damage that it can bring to your own life or to your own family. And you just have to separate from them. But again, that is not always the case, and really, that should be the exception in life, not the rule. In too many cases, no one tries. No one is willing to go that extra mile that Jesus talked about when in the Sermon on the Mount, He talked about go the second mile. Somebody said this, there are no traffic jams on the road where people are going the second mile. There are no traffic jams there. Not many people are trying to do that. In too many cases, no one is willing to take the initiative to do something about the relationship. Think about this. The most strained relationship of your life may have the potential of developing into the most special relationship of your life if you would be willing to work on it. Now, here's what we tend to do. We tend to just walk away from relationships that are difficult. But often when people walk away, they are not showing what is wrong with the other person. They are really showing what is wrong with themselves. Listen to that again. When you just walk away from relationships, you're not usually showing what's wrong with that other person. You're usually showing what's wrong with yourself. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. If it be possible. I wonder what the meaning of that word possible was. So I looked it up. And then I wondered, where else does that word occur? And what is the context of that word? If it be possible, is it possible for you to have a good relationship with that difficult person? That same Greek word for possible is used quite a few times in the New Testament. For instance, it's used in Matthew chapter 19, verse 26, where it says, with God, all things are possible. If it be possible, could I tell you, with God, it may well be possible, because with God, all things are possible. Let me ask you this question. If Jesus himself were to sit down with you and that other person and you both listened to the Lord, could you work out your problems? Could it be done? If it be possible, I'm talking about how you ought to want to work out problems and difficulties because the Lord wants you to, because your testimony is often at stake. That same Greek word for possible is translated mighty. In Luke chapter 1, verse 49, Mary speaking, she says, for he that is mighty hath done to me great things. And so if it be possible, if there is a God of possibilities who can do the impossible, who is mighty, then maybe you ought to let him work to work out that difficult relationship. In Romans chapter 15, verse 1, that same word possible, if it be possible, that same word is translated strong. It says, we then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not to please ourselves. Now, here's what we think. We think, I'm strong enough, I can walk away. But walking away usually means we are weak. As much as lieth in you, notice it, if it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men, as much as lieth in you, conflict shows what is inside you. It shows the strength or might or power of the God who works impossibilities as much as lieth in you, then conflict brings out the strength of God that is in you, that he offers to you according to the power that worketh in us. It shows that when we're able to work out sometimes these very difficult relationships. Listen to that verse again, Romans 15, 1. We then that are strong, there's that same word possible. We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not to please ourselves. The strong Christian bears the infirmities of weak Christians and pleases God rather than pleasing themselves. 1 Corinthians 13 describes the God kind of love and says that it beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Charity never faileth. Love never quits. It won't give up. Have you noticed that to do right in most areas of life means you have to do the opposite of your natural inclinations? And especially is that true in dealing with difficult relationships. The flesh, seldom ever wants to do what is uncomfortable, difficult, right, or best. The flesh says things like this: they want to live without me, I can live without them. There are too many people fighting with people they have no business fighting with. And they're wasting the minutes and hours and days and weeks of their lives as they do so. Yes, there is a time to take a stand. But you can have a sweet spirit even as you take a strong stand. And don't ever forget that if your spirit is wrong, then you are wrong. You may be crossing every I, dotting every T, but if your spirit is wrong, then you're wrong. I heard a while back about a man who had died. And the folks were talking about it. There was a discussion going on. And somebody said to me, "Well, his sister won't be at the funeral." I said, "Really?" And they said, "No, something happened years ago. Nobody remembers what it was. We wonder if even he or her remembered what it was." Do you get that? But they haven't spoken for years. Now what happened there? Something back yonder happened, but neither one of them wanted to work on it, and so they both just walked away from it. Somebody wrote in a Vice columnist, "My sister Lana and I are about to celebrate a year of not speaking to each other." Quotation marks around the word celebrate. "We're both adults with children of our own, but we had a fight that resulted in a phone hang up. And then it spilled over to her wedding." Man, weddings and funerals are scary times. Emotions are running so high. Expectations are so high. There is no time that can damage relationships like weddings especially, but also funerals. "It spilled over to her wedding. It is now snowballed, and at family events, she won't even look at me. Lana refuses to acknowledge her part in all this and is insistent that I should have apologized on her wedding day. I disagree, but in the end, it really doesn't matter. Nothing can change what's already happened. It's gotten so bad between us that we can no longer be in the same room together. Lana doesn't hide her feelings in front of her children or mine and has made it clear she may forgive me, but she'll never forget. I'm still not willing to grovel, but I believe that's what she wants. Is there any way to resolve things or at least get Lana to control herself in front of the children?" Now, what do you got here? You've got the disintegration of a relationship. You've got people just walking away from a relationship. I would assume these people probably don't know the Lord, but you know what? I've seen some Christians who do the same thing. Sisters who fight with sisters. The answer here was really very wise. Listen to it. "Are you willing never to speak to your sister again? This is where you're headed. It seems a steep price to pay for a disagreement, no matter how bad it was. Some of this is surely your fault, so we want you to swallow your pride and sincerely apologize to Lana for your part in the fight." Now notice this, because there's some wisdom here. There's usually fault on both sides, but both sides is really saying that it's totally the other person's fault. You know something I've learned? I've learned this. I can't control anybody else, but I'm responsible before God to control me. And I notice lots of times I want to get upset about something, and then I realize, you know what? That was not my responsibility. Their decision was not my responsibility. My decisions are my responsibility, and I'm just, before God, I don't have a right to try to control their life. And before God, my decisions are my responsibility, and I have to make sure that I do what God wants me to do. Let me read this again. "Some of this is surely your fault, so we want you to swallow your pride and sincerely apologize for your part in the fight. Tell her you miss her friendship and want your children to be close. It'd be nice if she did the same, but she sounds just as stubborn as you. However, you cared enough to write to us for help, so we believe you can be the bigger person. Please try." Here's what you usually find out. What's the verse again? "If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men." It often doesn't matter who talks to the other person. What matters is somebody's trying. If you know somebody has a problem with you, go to that other person. Jesus talked about that. So, want to. Well, how are you going to get along with difficult people? You got to want to because the Lord wants you to, because relationships is what life is all about, and your testimony as a Christian is often tied in with your relationship, and your relationship with Christ is tied in with your relationship with other people. Would he walk away from that person? Would he care about that person? Would he say, I'm not going to have anything to do with that person anymore? Or would he say, I love them? You say, but it hurts. And Jesus had to die on the cross to establish relationships with us. He had to suffer to establish relationships with us. And there are times when if you keep the relationships you should, or if you build the relationships you should, you will suffer to do so. But it's all right. Just go ahead and do it. Want to because the Lord wants you to. Secondly, how are you going to get along with difficult people? Don't forget that Satan is your number one enemy and wants to destroy your relationships. So often we view that other person as the enemy. He is my enemy. And you fail to see there is a third party in the room here, and his name is Satan, the devil, the adversary, Apollyon. He is Beelzebub. He is the master of iniquity and the master of deceit. And you don't realize it, but he is the enemy, not that other person. Now, it's real easy. I got to drive this home because it's real easy to forget this. It is real easy to forget that Satan is not neutral in this. The other person is not your enemy. I said the other person, your enemy is not really your enemy. Satan is really your enemy. Would you say that with me? Your enemy is not your enemy. Satan is your enemy. Now, whoever that person is making life difficult for you, they are not. I said they are not. I said they are not. I think I said they are not your enemy. Is anybody getting this yet? Satan is your enemy. Listen to the verse. 1 Peter 5:8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion walketh about seeking whom he may devour. Satan is trying to devour you. And he's using this relationship to do it. Somebody said, Satan's best kept secret is that he wants to destroy us through relationships. And he wants to destroy relationships. God is a builder. Satan is a destroyer. 1 Thessalonians 2:18, the Apostle Paul wrote, wherefore we would have come unto you, even I, Paul, once and again, but Satan hindered us. Satan hindered Paul from being able to get to the church at Thessalonica to spend time with them. Expect this. Hear me. Expect Satan to hinder relationships. Satan hinders relationships. Say it, would you please? Satan hinders relationships. Say it again. Satan hinders relationships. The word hinders there, I looked it up in the Greek. It means to cut into, to impede one's course by cutting off his way. Joshua and Caleb, run up here right quick. Would you please? Let me show you what I'm talking about. All right. Let's see. Caleb. Keep me from getting to Joshua, all right? I'm going to get to Joshua. You keep me from getting there, all right? I need to have a good relationship with Joshua, all right? He's my grandson. I need to have a good relationship with him. And so I've got to be with him to do that. You know what Satan tries? Satan keeps you from getting to that other person. You think that it's that other person. You think that it's those problems. It is not. It is Satan. Thank you, fellas. It is Satan who cuts you off. The word hinder means to cut into, to impede one's course by cutting off his way. Satan is the one responsible for all the abortions. Millions and millions of little unborn babies aborted. You know what has happened? Satan has cut off the relationship between the mother and the baby. Satan has caused the mother to not love her unborn child like she should love her unborn child. And Satan cuts off that relationship with one that God meant. Think about this. God meant for this relationship between the mother and the unborn baby to be a lifelong, wonderful, precious, very special relationship. How many mothers here have children? Let's see hands. How many of you love those children? Bible talks about, can a mother forget her child? And it's astounding. In our day, we have mothers just... I talked to a lady just a few weeks ago who said to me, My mother actually stood in a courtroom with me there. And because she wanted to spend time with a boyfriend and live with a boyfriend who didn't care for me, she stood in a courtroom and I heard her say the words in front of the judge, I no longer want her as my daughter. And that young lady is telling me that. I knew that mother. I remember her. I spoke to her on several different occasions. She claimed to be a Christian, but she was willing to chop off this. Now, wait a minute. Who is ultimately behind that? Satan was ultimately behind that. I'm thinking right now of a couple with whom years ago I had a wonderful relationship. And then the day came when that couple desperately needed me. And Satan saw that day coming and got them angry and bitter at me and cut off from me so that they would not get the help they needed when the time came they would need it. You wouldn't believe how many people get... That's what the Bible's talking about in Hebrews 13 when it says, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. You wouldn't believe how many people are going to need a pastor, and just before they really desperately need their pastor, Satan steps in there somehow or other and ruins the relationship with their pastor. So that then when they need him, and that couple wound up divorced. By the way, years have gone by since that time, and by the grace of God now, I've been able to rebuild with God's help. God has helped us to rebuild the relationship on both sides now. But what if Satan had not been able to get in there and hinder that relationship? Who do teenagers need worse than anyone else? Not their friends, their parents. What do you hear? My parents are driving me wacko. And what do parents say? I'm at the end of my rope with my daughter. Then you need to tie on an extra rope at the bottom of that rope and not give up. Why does alienation come? It is Satan's plan to weaken us. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 9 and 10, powerful passage of Scripture. I wonder if any preacher in America preaches Ecclesiastes 4, 9 and 10 as much as it needs to be preached. Two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, hear me, you're going to fall sometime. If they fall, the one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. Two, produce more than twice the power or work of one. Do you hear that? Two. Produce more than twice the power of or the work of one. And 10 are more powerful than 2. And 100 are more powerful than 10. And 1,000 are more powerful than 100. Proverbs 17:14 warns, the beginning of strife is as when one letteth out water. It's talking about a dam breaking. Therefore, leave off contention before it be meddled with. In other words, if you see strife and contention starting to happen, try to stop it quick. Plug the hole in the dike before it turns into a raging river. Now, I want you to remember that verse because I'm going to come back to it later. But as I was driving home Way late last night on the radio, I heard the report on the news from the state of Washington, a breach in a dam, 800 homes underwater. The beginning of strife is as when one letteth out water, therefore leave off contention before it be meddled with. Don't forget that Satan is your number one enemy and wants to destroy your relationships. Third, make sure that your words and your actions build and apologize quickly when they do not. Make sure your words and actions build and apologize quickly when they do not. James 1:26. If any man among you seem to be religious, well, he goes to church three times a week, he tithes, he goes soul winning. If any man among you seem to be religious, he helps other people and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart. He deceives his own heart because he does all these religious things, but he bridles not his tongue. This man's religion is vain. All it takes for your... And see, salvation is what God does for man. We're all lost sinners on our way to hell. We must repent of our sin and receive Jesus as Savior. We cannot do enough good works to go to heaven. We must trust Christ alone for salvation. Salvation is what God does for man. Religion, in many ways, is what man does for God. So, if any man among you seem to be religious, boy, he's got all the trappings. It looks good outside, but he bridles not his tongue. That man's religion is vain. What's even more dangerous is he's deceiving his own heart. He's deceiving himself. He thinks everything's fine. Oh, I walked away from that relationship. And man, I gave that person a piece of my mind, and they really needed it. And you know I was frank with that person, but I assured them and I loved them. And that person's religion is vain. Your tongue, he bridleth not his tongue. Your tongue needs a bridle. My tongue needs a bridle. All of our tongue needs a bridle. My tongue needs a bridle. Say it, would you please? My tongue needs a bridle. Your tongue needs that. Don't just say what you're thinking. You would not believe the crazy things that have come into my mind sometime while I'm preaching. Or I've thought about saying before I ever walked out. That's one reason I use so many notes. I'm trying to bridle this tongue because I know what it can do. I've thought a few times, a preacher could stand up and in two sentences blow church right in half. I won't tell you what those sentences are. I don't want you to hear them. But it can be done. I'm telling you, that's all it would take. 1 Peter 3:10, for he that will love life and see good days, let him refrain his tongue from evil. They really needed to hear that. Let him refrain his tongue from evil and his lips that they speak no guile. Probably the number one way we destroy relationships is with angry words. Proverbs 11:9, and hypocrite with his mouth destroyeth his neighbor. 1 Kings 20:23, one statement cost 127,000 men their lives. Check it out. Somebody wrote an advice column and said, listen to this. We're talking about the power of the tongue. Make sure your words and actions build and apologize quickly when they don't. Somebody wrote, I'm in the sixth grade. Other kids make fun of me. Last week I didn't go to school because I had a headache. I'm sure it's stress and it's making me afraid and affecting my schoolwork. It started in the first grade. I don't know why, but they just felt like it. Last year was the worst of my life. The kids call me fat, stupid, idiot, dumb, worthless, that I'm not fit to live, and so many other things, I lost count. One of those girls said in front of the only two friends I have, wow, you finally got some friends in what, 5 years? I thought I'd just curl up and die. My friends said they didn't care what anybody said. My mom works long hours and always comes home tired, so I don't want to burden her with what's happening in school. I'm 11 and don't think I can take it much longer. Somebody said, sticks and stones may break my bones. Words will never hurt me. May I suggest to you, sticks and stones may break your bones, but words can hurt you much worse. I've had times I just assumed somebody had picked up a rock and hit me with it. I think I'd have rather them hit me with that rock than hit me with those words. Alienation begins with a wrong action or a wrong statement or a perceived wrong action or statement, followed by a reaction. Followed by another reaction and another and another and another, and the tension is building between these people. Until eventually those two people blow apart and go their own separate ways. They may be cruel or cordial to each other in the future. One may be cruel while the other is cordial, but the relationship is ended either temporarily or permanently. Make sure your words and actions build and apologize quickly when they do not. Quickly! Don't wait 24 hours. Don't wait 48 hours. When you realize you've said something you shouldn't say, apologize right then. You will never have a better opportunity. When you've done something you shouldn't do, don't walk around defending yourself. Don't walk around saying, well, you know, they needed to hear that. They needed a piece of my mind. Quit defending yourself. Apologize quickly. Number four, love somebody enough to tolerate their weaknesses without always feeling you have to correct them. Did you hear that? I said, love somebody enough to tolerate their weaknesses without always feeling you have to correct them. Let me give you some scriptures here. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 12. Hatred stirreth up strifes, but love covereth all sins. Love says, you know what? I know that person's faults. I'm not going to tell you. And in fact, you know what? I've been around them long enough. What I could say to them about it, I've already said. And I can't say anything else without damaging the relationship. So, I'm just going to love it. I'm going to love them. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 8. And above all things, have fervent charity, fervent love, fervent self-sacrifice among yourselves. Fervent. For charity, that's the God kind of love, shall cover the multitude of sins. You say, but boy, they got a problem in this area and a problem in this area and a problem in this area. Yeah, and you probably should love them enough to tolerate that without always feeling like you have to straighten them out. Some people think the number one characteristic of love is correction. But kindness is more an attribute of love than correction. Ephesians 4:32, and be ye kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Be careful with correction. It often comes across like a sharp sword, and it may chop that other person up. Listen to these quotes I found in the book. Love makes you kind, and kindness makes you likable. The kind person will be the one who greets first, smiles first, serves first, and forgives first. They don't require the other to get his or her act together before showing love. Ken Sandy gives four questions to ask to know whether an offense is serious enough to confront a brother or sister. Listen to this. Four questions to ask to know whether an offense is serious enough to confront a brother or sister. First of all, is the offense seriously dishonoring God? Or is it just upsetting you? Has it permanently damaged a relationship? Or is it just an irritation to you? Is it seriously hurting other people? Or is it seriously hurting the offender himself? And even then, let's say you answer all four of those, you still have to say to yourself, before you get yourself involved in something like that, you have to say, now, wait a minute, is this really something I can do? Will they receive this from me or not? Have y'all been hearing about that book, The Love Dare? It's a book I hardly ever talk about movies, and you know that, and I'm not recommending this movie. I've just heard a lot about it, and I do thank God for the positive impact it seems to be having. The movie called Fireproof. I'm hearing of marriages all over the nation being saved by people watching that movie. And I'm not promoting movies today. I thank God in that movie, this husband he and his wife are about to be blown apart. Boy, how many times does Hollywood show people just living together as normal? Makes me sick. How many times does Hollywood show marriage as a wonderful thing? And how many times does Hollywood show a husband and wife getting back together as a wonderful thing? That's the good thing about that movie. And again, I'm not promoting the movie. I'm just telling you what I've heard about it. But in that movie, the book, The Love Dare, is this, somebody challenges this man who he and his wife are having major problems. It looks like they're about to split up. Challenges him to take that book and to use it. And the book, I was at my doctor's office the other day, and my doctor said, "Have you heard about that book?" And I said, "Yes, I have." He said, "Do you have a copy?" And I said, "No." And he's a Christian man. He said, "I'll give you a copy." And he gave me a copy of the book, and I've been reading it for the last couple of weeks now. And I'm going to do something I don't hardly ever do. I'm going to read you several paragraphs out of that book. It's one of the most powerful things I've ever read in my life. And it's based on 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where love believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Listen to this. I read this, and then I believe it was Friday, I turned to my wife and I said, "Honey, you have got to hear this." And I read this to her sitting at home. In the deep and private corridors of your heart, there is a room that is called the appreciation room. It's where your thoughts go when you encounter positive and encouraging things about your spouse. And I want you to think, I'm going to read this like it is, but I want you to think about this in not just your mate relationships, but all the other relationships of life. The appreciation room is where you go to encounter positive and encouraging things about that other person. And every so often, you enjoy visiting that special place. On the walls are written kind words and phrases describing the good attributes of your mate or that other person. These may include characteristics like honest, intelligent, or phrases like diligent worker, wonderful cook, or beautiful eyes. They are things you've discovered about your husband or wife that have embedded themselves in your memory. When you think about these things, your appreciation for your spouse begins to increase. In fact, the more time you spend meditating on these positive attributes, the more grateful you are for your mate or that other person. Most things in the appreciation room were likely written in the initial stages of your relationship. You could summarize them as things you liked and respected about your loved one. They were true, honorable, and good, and you spent a deal of time dwelling on them in the appreciation room before you were married. But you may have found that you don't visit that special room as often as you once did. That's because there is another competing room nearby. Down another darker corridor of your heart lies the depreciation room. And unfortunately, you visit there as well. And on its walls are written the things that bother and irritate you about your spouse or that other person. Those things were placed there out of frustration, hurt feelings, and the disappointment of unmet expectations. The depreciation room is lined with the weaknesses and failures of your husband, wife, or this other person. Their bad habits, hurtful words, and poor decisions are written in large letters that cover the walls from one end to the other. If you stay in this room long enough, you get depressed and start expressing things like, "My wife is so selfish. My husband can be such a jerk." Or maybe, "I think I married the wrong person." Some people write very hateful things in this room, where tell-off statements are rehearsed for the next argument. Emotional injuries fester here, adding more scathing remarks to the walls. It's where ammunition is kept for the next big fight, and bitterness is allowed to spread like a disease. People fall out of love in this room. But know this, spending time in the depreciation room kills marriages forever. Spending time in that room kills any relationship. Divorces are plotted in this room and violent plans are schemed. The more time you spend in this place, the more your heart devalues your spouse. It begins the moment you walk in the door and your care for them lessens with every second that ticks by. You may say, but these things are true. Yes, but so are the things in the appreciation room. Are y'all getting this? Somebody say amen. Everyone fails and has areas that need growth. Everyone has unresolved issues, hurts, and personal baggage. That's a sad aspect of being human. We've all sinned. But we have this unfortunate tendency to downplay our own negative attributes while putting our partner's failures under a magnifying glass. Let's get down to the real issue here. Love knows about the depreciation room and does not live in denial that it exists, but it chooses not to live there. You must decide to stop running to this room and lingering there after every frustrating event in your relationship. It does you no good and drains the joy out of your marriage. Love chooses to believe the best about people. It gives them the benefit of the doubt. It refuses to fill in the unknowns with negative assumptions. And when our worst hopes are proven to be true, love makes every effort to deal with them and move forward. As much as possible, love focuses on the positive. It's time to start thinking differently. It's time to let love lead your thoughts and your focus. The only reason you should glance in the door of the depreciation room is to know how to pray for that other person. And the only reason you should ever go in that room is to write in huge letters across the walls, covered in love. It is time to move into the appreciation room to settle down and make it your home. As you choose to meditate on the positives, you'll learn that many more wonderful character qualities could be written across those walls. Your spouse is a living, breathing, endless book to be read. Dreams and hopes have yet to be realized. Talents and abilities may be discovered like hidden treasure. But the choice to explore them starts with a decision by you. Could I ask you, in this difficult relationship that you're thinking about right now, where are you living? In the appreciation room or the depreciation room? Remember my point? Love somebody enough to tolerate their weaknesses without always feeling you have to correct them. Humility is being more interested in correcting your own faults than you are the other person's. When we're more interested in straightening out the other person, that's usually an indication of pride. I love the statement evangelist Tom Williams said. Listen to this. He said, anybody can live with anybody if they're willing to be a nobody. Anybody can live with anybody if they're willing to be a nobody. It is the somebody in us that keeps us from building relationships or solving relationship problems. Have the wisdom. Have the wisdom to know if talking about something is going to damage a relationship. And if so, you should probably leave it alone. I did not do that several years ago. I had a preacher friend, and he ran a special ministry where a lot of other people were involved in that ministry, and I was talking to another preacher friend, and he was not going to take part in that ministry, and I thought something was wrong there, and I was going to fix that thing. These preacher friends were two of my good friends, and I thought, I'm going to fix this. So I called up this preacher that had the ministry the others were involved in, and I said, this other brother's got a problem with you. How about calling him? And so he did. And the other preacher said, well, you know, I don't have a problem with you, really. Not, I don't choose to be involved in your ministry, but I don't really have a problem with you. And this other preacher called him back and said, why did I call him? I had to fix that thing. I'm a fixer. Man, I see something's broke. I got to fix it. Some people might try to apply Proverbs 20. By the way, remember the verse I referred to a while ago? I said, coming back to it, remember that verse? Proverbs 17:14, the beginning of strife is when one letteth out water, therefore leave off contention before it be meddled with. Apply that to this point. Love somebody enough to tolerate their weaknesses without always feeling like you have to correct them. I've seen people walk into a situation, I'm going to correct this problem, and all they did was create a breach and a dam. And the water came pouring out and flooded them and everybody around them. Some people try to apply Proverbs 27:17 to every relationship. It says, iron sharpeneth iron, so a man sharpeneth the countenance of his friend. And they say, well, we need to grade on one another to help each other. But that verse can't always be applied in every relationship. Sometimes a level of love and trust has to be built first. Sometimes it requires a relationship where a friend has actually asked to be corrected. I have a couple of close friends. Actually, probably three or four friends that I have said to them, say anything you want to me at any time. I need to hear it. I want to hear it. I had one of those friends about 6 weeks ago who said some very strong things to me. And after he did, he wrote me a letter, email, and he said, I hope I didn't offend you. I wrote him back and I said, you cannot offend me. I have given you permission to say anything you want to me. I appreciate you saying what you said. Say whatever you need to in the future. But we have built up a level of trust there. Sometimes you have to, if you're not one of those that a friend has asked, say this, say anything you need to me, then you can't always say it. Listen to this quote. It's important to our friends to believe that we are unreservedly frank with them, and important to our friendship that we are not. Listen to that again. It's important for our friends to believe that we are unreservedly frank with them, and important to our friendship that we are not. Number five, how can you get along with difficult people? Enlist the help of godly third parties when you need to. Matthew chapter 18, verse 15 and 16, listen to it. Jesus said, moreover, if thy brother shall trespass against thee, go and tell him his fault between thee and him alone. Notice there's got to be a trespass there. If he shall hear thee, thou hast gained thy brother. But if he will not hear thee, and sometimes you know you can't approach this, but you've got to approach it, what do? Take with thee one or two more than the mouth of two or three witnesses, and every word may be established. So you take somebody with you. This should be somebody respected and trusted by both parties. But the key qualification for this person is their own spirituality. Micah chapter 3 verse 8 says, but truly I am full of power by the Spirit of the Lord and of judgment and of might. Why? To declare unto Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. Listen to me. If a person is not truly walking with God, where they're full of the power of the Spirit of the Lord, then they're probably not going to have judgment. They're probably not going to have might. They're going to have difficulty declaring the transgression to anybody. All of that is desperately needed. Godly ladies may be called upon to help in this area when needed. I've seen godly ladies in our own church who have helped two other ladies work out problems. But the key people I think of who should be called on are the double elders in the church. What do I mean by that? Men who are men of age and men of spiritual experience of many years. My wife and I were discussing a situation this week, and I said to my wife, those people need Mr. B. He is a double elder. He's a godly man. He could sit down with them and help them with this. Where there is conflict, there is often more fault on one side than the other, but there's almost always wrong on both sides that must be dealt with. And the third party speaks to both sides and may say to him, now share your grievance. We will not interrupt. Now share yours. Let's keep our voices calm. Leave correction with me. That's not your purvey. That's mine. Do you realize why that was wrong? Do you realize why this upset them? Let me explain to you what was wrong with that. Do you understand why you need to apologize? And these are things the third party is saying. Are you willing to apologize to? You need to say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. Number six, try to stay away from things that might permanently damage relationships. How are you going to get along with difficult people? Try not to get involved in things that are going to permanently damage relationships. I'm talking about words or activities. And you know what I thought of when I thought of that right away? I thought about the boyfriend-girlfriend game. Boy, how that permanently damages relationships. Do you know There are people that I can have virtually no contact with to this day because I played the boyfriend-girlfriend game when I was a young man. And it wiped out the potential for relationship for the rest of life. Listen to this one. Yesterday, my wife and I were called to our son's school to talk to the crisis prevention officer. We were told our 16-year-old son had attempted suicide. You can imagine our shock. Where were the signs and the clues? We have a high honors achieving son, an athlete with friends, a Boy Scout, a member of the National Honor Society. He's all a parent could hope for. There have been no arguments, no rebellion, no drugs, no alcohol, no staying out or running away, no complaints about school or home. I'm involved in his life, attending his athletic events. I'm his scoutmaster. While he's not exactly verbose, we do talk. There was a recent breakup with his first girlfriend, and that apparently was the trigger. When I talked to him about the breakup, he said, "I'm okay, we're still friends," but the continued contact between them was more than he could handle. What has happened there? A relationship has been damaged for life. It probably will never be repaired. Listen to this one. For 3 years, I've been regularly emailing an old boyfriend. We're both married to others. My husband isn't aware of the correspondence because I always use the computer at work. However, my ex-boyfriend's wife just found out and wrote me a very distraught email, I guess. I replied, "It wasn't my fault she's in an unhappy marriage." You see how people put the blame on somebody else? Now I feel guilty and I'm thinking of apologizing. Should I? I know I wouldn't want my husband to find out what I've been doing. Signed, old girlfriend. The advice columnist writes back, "You should apologize not only for what you said, but for what you've been doing. When your husband discovers your secret correspondence, he eventually will. Your marriage could be over. Is it worth it? Stop." What am I saying? I'm saying stay away from things that permanently damage relationships. Have you read the recent news articles about thousands of young people who have signed purity pledges? And it said there is no difference between those who sign purity pledges and those who do not, as far as them losing their purity. A major study was done, like 11,000 young people or something, said we can't tell any difference at all. Do you know why? Because it is not enough to stay fit, to simply say I will be physically pure. You have to stay emotionally pure. You have to move a step back from that to where God draws the line. And if you don't, it doesn't matter what else you do. And until our society and our churches and Christians in America wake up to it, we will continue to have the devastation. How do you get along with difficult people? Want to, because the Lord wants you to. Don't forget, Satan's your number one enemy. Make sure your words and actions build and apologize quickly when they don't. Love somebody enough to tolerate their weaknesses without always feeling like you have to correct them. Enlist the help of godly third parties when you need to. Try to stay away from things that will permanently damage relationships. And last, picture life ending without you doing what you could have done and should have done. How are you going to get along with difficult people? You picture life is over and I didn't take care of that matter. A pastor in Texas, Garland, Texas, preached a dad's funeral. A boy had evidently said some things he should have never said. At the close of the funeral, the family was going by and the boy fell on his daddy's body screaming, "Daddy, Daddy, I didn't mean it." Almost pulled his dad's body out of the casket. And think of that person that you should be getting along with, but you're having difficulties. And what if the end of life came today, and you left undone whatever you should have done? I began with the story of a man who remembered what happened when he was 8 years old, and his dad and mommy walked in and found them physically fighting. Dad had mom down on the floor, and mom was kicking and screaming. They were grabbing, pulling at each other's clothes, and the little boy started crying and begging his parents to stop fighting. They told him to get out of the room, and they continued physically fighting. And with the images he had just seen burned into his little mind, the little boy left the living room and went four rooms away to his bedroom in another wing of the house. But the sounds of the screaming and scuffling bled through the walls to where he was standing. He put his hands on his ears and started pacing back and forth, but he could still hear. He tried singing with his ears covered, but he could still hear. In desperation, he put his head under the covers of the bed, wrapped them over his ears, and started praying as loud as he could, "God, please help Mama and Daddy to stop. Please, please, God, help them to stop." And he wasn't sure what happened after that. He thinks they finally stopped fighting and started talking things out. And you know what his biggest fear of all was? That Dad and Mom wouldn't stay together. By the way, they did stay together. And a few years after the incident I related to you, they, with God's help, built a strong and peaceable and loving relationship that lasted until they parted in death. They're both in heaven now. And they're glad they stayed together and learned to live peaceably with one another. Would you bow with me, please?